Now stand, if you sit rather. We'll ask Brother Lynn to step forward and to provide us with our first study entitled The Bride's Love, Humility and Devotion. Brother Lynn, please.
Hello, everyone. I guess it's my turn to stand. It's great to be here and have this last period of time to visit with many of you, and I look forward to visiting with all of the rest of you also. Since this is the first address of our study this weekend, I thought I would go through a little bit of a summary of the whole book of Song of Solomon, and then we'll get into the first couple of songs. The book opens with a verse that just says the Song of Songs. We read in 1 Kings 4:32, "He spake 3,000 proverbs, and his songs were 1,005. Now, of all of these, this was the most important. This was the Song of Songs. Read in 1 Corinthians 13:13. "Now abideth faith, hope, charity, these three, but the greatest of these is charity," or love. And we'll find that that is the overall theme of this song, and that is love. Some of the things that we can watch for throughout this book, and we'll find more than one of these in any one given song, but just some things to watch out for, is the interaction between the bride, the bridegroom, and the virgins. The love, humility, and devotion that the bride shows for her bridegroom. The bride longing for her absent groom. The beauty of the bride. The appearance of the bridegroom. And we'll also look at these three characters, the bride, the bridegroom, and the virgins, and what they symbolize. We see that the bride symbolizes a perfected ecclesia. The virgins would be individual members of that ecclesia. And of course, the bridegroom himself would be Christ. So as we look at these songs, try to keep these themes and these characters in mind. Now, Song of Solomon can be divided into, and it has been by several analysts of this book, into 12 songs, and they seem to fit pretty well. And I'll just read out just kind of the theme of each of these songs, and we're going to be looking at the first two. First one is the bride in the king's chambers. The second one is the bridegroom and the bride in a garden retreat. The third is the bridegroom's call and her response. Number four, the bride's midnight search for her beloved. Number five, a state visit to the bride, praises her beauty. And the sixth, the bride compared to a lovely garden. Now, instead of looking at these as 7 through 12, we really can look at them as 1 through 6 again, and we'll just talk about that briefly in a second. But the remaining six songs are the portrait of her beloved and reply, the eighth, the overtaken by impulse to hide herself, speaking of the bride, the description of the bride's person by the virgins, the bride's invitation to the bridegroom, love, unquenchable, and finally a conclusion. Now, if we look at these as a sequence of songs 1 through 12, they'll appear to be somewhat out of order, because at one song we'll see that the bridegroom has appeared, and then at a later song we'll see that the bride is looking for her groom. And so it doesn't seem to make sense. But if we took these as two sets of six, then the order makes more sense. We lose that those inconsistencies. And there's a further application of this too. The first six can apply to the Jews and their part in becoming the multitudinous bride, and the second six to the Gentiles becoming their part of the multitudinous bride. As we said, Songs 1 and 2 are the two that we're going to look at in a little more detail. And the first one is the bride in the king's chambers. And the second song is the bridegroom and the bride in the garden retreat. And those are broken up not by the chapters, but the first one is chapter 1, verses 2 through 8. And the second one starts at verse 9 and goes through to chapter 2, verse 7. Now, I thought the most interesting way to look at this, and the most that I learned in this study, is to look at this not by verses as much as by who is speaking to who. It's more of a conversation, a dialogue between the three characters that we mentioned. And so we'll look at these more in that context. And with each set of verses, or even part of a verse, we'll do that, and then we'll look at that just that piece of conversation one at a time. So in verses 2 through 4, the speaker is the bride to the virgins and also to her absent groom. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth, for thy love is better than wine. Because of the savor of thy good ointments, thy name is as ointment poured forth. Therefore do the virgins love thee. And the fourth verse is really just part of it. It's, draw me. And that's the end of the bride speaking. So we think of the kiss. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. We can see many examples throughout scriptures of a kiss and the different things that they can mean. And I just I'll list out some that I have found. Allegiance, compassion, forgiveness, friendship, affection, love. And probably the one that applies here the most is friendship, as we'll see in a little bit later a progression that the bride is showing in towards her groom. But this kiss could mean all of these things. And if we think about a perfect love and a kiss being a symbol of that love, perhaps it does include all of these aspects. Says that love is better than wine. Thy love is better than wine, speaking of the groom's love. If we think of wine, it's something that can be refreshing and stimulating and strengthening to us. And I've got many references here. I think this will probably be on a website that you can look at. I'm not going to read out too many of these. But it also can symbolize in the Old Testament of a life dedicated. We know that wine is the symbol of shed blood. Being trod under by the foot of men, so the grapes being trod under by the foot of men to make the wine, which also includes the fermentation process, all of that process brings forth new life. And this is the symbol of our Lord and Savior being trodden down under the foot of men, only to be brought forth to life anew. It says, because of the savor of thy good ointments, thy name is as ointment poured forth. And we know from the Old Testament that ointment was used for things set apart, something that is holy. It was used as regards the high priest. We read of that in Psalms and also throughout the Law of Moses. We also know that Christ was an anointed one. And from the Law of Moses, the special ointment that was not used for anything else was used to anoint the high priest and his sons. Of course, we know that Jesus was anointed. And this special anointing with the Holy Spirit was pointed forward from the law of Moses back when it was applied to the high priest. Ointment was often used for healing. It was something that was costly to purchase. And it was generally only noticed when it was applied. We know that there were two women that anointed Jesus. We can read about those in the Gospels. One was a sinner, one was a saint. But they both applied that ointment. So I think we can see the analogy there of the ointment, of its healing powers, and how, as it says, is when it is poured forth, the savor of thy good ointment is poured forth. It is using the word. It's something that we can do to use the word and apply it in our daily lives. And the final part of that section was where the words draw me. And this is the bride talking to the groom at this point, even though the groom is not present. She's wanting the groom to draw her forth. And it shows that the groom has authority. He has drawn her, and she also feels drawn to him. Now, when we are drawn out, that can lead to baptism. But we must continue from there. There must be more than just an attraction of being drawn one to another. We read in John 6:44, "No man can come to me except the Father which has sent me draw him, and I will raise him up at the last day." Now the next bit of conversation continues in verse 4, right after "draw me," and it's the virgins speaking to the bride. And they say, "We will run after thee." And the bride replies, "The king hath brought me into his chambers." So the chambers, from the Hebrew, it means an inner room. And it's the same as in Psalm 45, verses 14 and 15. The same word is used there. "She shall be brought unto the king in raiment of needlework. The virgins, her companions that follow her, shall be brought unto thee. With gladness and rejoicing shall they be brought. They shall enter into the king's palace." So this sets the stage. This is the exact same kind of reference of the bride and the virgins being drawn in, waiting for the groom in the king's palace. It was a custom in those times for a new queen to be brought into the king's chambers for purification before the marriage. And we can read about that in the book of Esther. And there's further reference to that in Colossians chapter 3. Now the virgins reply to the bride, continuing in verse 4. "We will be glad and rejoice in thee. We will remember thy love more than wine. The upright love thee." So this is the virgins talking to the bride that they will run after thee. We know if we run after someone that we strive to be with them. Now, anything that we strive for, of course, we don't always get. And we have a great example of that. And it's also speaking of virgins, the five wise and the five foolish virgins. And so that's something that we have to keep in mind in this type of the virgins being part of the ecclesia, that not all are wise. Some may be foolish. Now, as believers, we should rejoice that we are part of the ecclesia, that we are part of the group of virgins. They also want to enter the royal palace with the queen, with the bride. It says, "We will remember thy love more than wine." We know that the effects of wine, we said that, you know, the great effects that it has, that it's strengthening and refreshing. But the effects of wine eventually will wear off. But this says that love will remember thy love more than wine. And as we already stated, that love is the greatest of all the virtues that were mentioned. Now if we go to verse 5, the bride again speaks and says, "I am black," to which the virgins reply, "But comely." Perhaps a better translation of this word black is more of brown, but it's referring to an exposure to the sun that has impaired the beauty, at least in the bride's eyes, impaired her own beauty. Now this shows modesty, and we'll find this throughout this song and throughout some of the other songs as well. Now the bride to the virgins says, "O ye daughters of Jerusalem, as the tents of Kedar." Now the tents of Kedar that are referred to by the bride is back to when she said that she was black. The tents of Kedar were made of goat's hair, and when exposed to the sun, just as the bride was, they would tend to turn black and be quite ugly to look at. And we also know that Kedar is the son of Ishmael, which is Israel after the flesh. So this shows some of the negative aspects of the bride. Now the virgins reply to the bride, but once again, trying to encourage her, they say, "As the curtains of Solomon," so that she is not as ugly as she thinks she might be. But she is actually more beautiful, even as the curtains of Solomon. So they're reassuring her of her beauty. She is modest and she finds fault in herself, but she is reassured of her beauty. Well, the curtains of Solomon, it could be referring to the curtains that were in Solomon's house that he built, or it could also refer to the curtain between the holy and most holy place, that veil there, that beautiful veil. Now, once again, we have the bride speaking back to the virgins. But notice as we go through these, the application to the ecclesia and to the individuals of the ecclesia. How that the bride, the ecclesia, may see that there are problems, but the individuals can help the overall look of the ecclesia by encouraging one another. So once again, the bride is not satisfied with how she looks. She says in verse 6, "Look not upon me, because I am black, because the sun hath looked upon me. My mother's children were angry with me. They made me the keeper of the vineyards. But mine own vineyard have I not kept." So even though that they are trying to comfort her and reassure her that she indeed is beautiful, she ignores that. She still is unsure of herself. The sun, she mentions the sun had turned her dark. And we see a reference of that in John 30:30, of how the sun can try us and show weakness. It's an exposure. Now if we contrast this with white, of course, which we know symbolizes righteousness, so this darkness is sinfulness and a negative aspect of the bride. And she mentions that she was cast out to serve in another's vineyard. This is referring to, as we mentioned, the first six we're talking about natural Israel. And so we know that natural Israel was also cast out to serve in another vineyard. And we can contrast this with a later song that will speak of the bride possessing her own vineyard once again. Now, if we look at that, we can think of the suffering of God's people being cast out and how they have suffered throughout time, even in our lifetime. We can see the suffering of Christ Himself being cast out. We can read of that in Isaiah 53. We're all familiar with that chapter. So it's a question for us that we can ask ourselves, what vineyard do we spend our time in? The people of Israel were cast out of them, their vineyard. They had no choice. But we have a choice to where we want to spend our time. Which vineyard do we want to strive to be in? Continuing on with verse 7, we now have the bride speaking to the groom. Now the groom has not appeared yet, but the bride is longing for the groom. And she says, "Tell me, O thou whom my soul loveth, where thou feedest, where thou makest thy flock to rest at noon, for why should I be as one that turneth aside by the flocks of thy companions? Where thou makest thy flock to rest at noon." And notice here, this is a progression that I had referred to earlier. It says, "Tell me." And if we look back at a few verses earlier, verse 2, it says, "Kiss me." And that's a development of a friendship, or a development of that perfect love through all those aspects of the symbol of a kiss. In verse 4, we saw, "Draw me," which we discussed was the acknowledgement of authority and the request to be near. And now, "Tell me." Basically, tell me what I should do. What can I do to follow you and to show my love for you? It says, "Tell me, O whom my soul loveth." The word for love is agapeo there, which is not found outside the Bible. This is that perfect love. And in speaking of at noon, it says, "Because the sun hath," I'm sorry, "where thou makest thy flock to rest at noon." And at noon, of course, we know is where the sun is at its height. And we read about the damaging effects of the sun. And it's when the trials are at our worst. And it says that the flock, he makes the flock to rest at noon. So he gives them shelter, gives them rest when they're at the worst of the trials that they would be trying to overcome. "For why should I be as one that turneth aside by the flocks of thy companions?" We read in the Revised Version, "as one that is veiled." And that word veiled is interesting there, because we know in a wedding that the bride is veiled until the marriage takes place. So the multitudinous bride of Christ will be veiled until judgment. And also, there's an application there of veiled. If something is veiled, then it makes us that we can't see what we're doing. So there could be an application there as well. "Why should I be as one that turneth aside, or one that is veiled by the flocks of thy companions?" So if there could be others that are around us, the flocks of our companions, that are maybe guiding us astray. They could veil us to the truth. So we must make sure that we use the Bible as our guide. In Now we have the groom entering the picture. He says, "If thou know not, O thou fairest among women, go thy way forth by the footsteps of the flock, and feed thy kids beside the shepherd's tents." Now, Brother Dave will talk a little bit about this Sunday morning. But here, we see that the groom rebukes the bride, but does acknowledge that she is indeed righteous. He calls her fairest among women, and we see this several times in this song and the next song. And he says, "Go thy way forth by the footsteps of the flock." Now, of course, footsteps are something that we can follow. They're easily seen, and tracking an animal or anything, we use their footsteps. Now, the ones for us to follow are in the examples of the righteous that are throughout Scriptures. And if we follow those same footsteps of those that are righteous, then we will end up in the same position as those that we have followed. Conversely, if we follow those examples that are not so righteous, then we'll end up with the same and in the same position that they will be in at the time of judgment, at the time of the marriage. We read in 1 Corinthians 11:1, "Be followers of me," this is Paul speaking, "even as I also am of Christ." So we have many examples directly commanding us to follow these righteous men and women. And of course, we can pick out who the good examples are very easily, those that are righteous. Now that concludes Song 1. Now Song 2 picks up at verse 9 there and goes through chapter 2 and through to verse 7. And kind of the main theme of this is the devotion of the bride to the bridegroom. So this will be a conversation mainly between the bride and the bridegroom. Starts out with verses 9 and 10 of the groom speaking to the bride. "I have compared thee, O my love, to a company of horses in Pharaoh's chariots. Thy cheeks are comely with rows of jewels, thy neck with chains of gold." And I don't know how many husbands out there have compared their wives to horses. I'm not sure if they've done that, how well that's gone. But we'll see several examples that we think, at least on the surface, may not make any sense or be maybe the right thing to be doing. But if we look at horses, Pharaoh's horses were, of course, very well-bred. And a well-bred horse will respond instantly with just a little pressure on the bridle to whichever direction is desired. We read about that analogy in James. And Pharaoh's horses that pulled their chariots, there were two horses per chariot, and they worked perfectly together. And we can see how the Jew and the Gentile, if we put these two sets of six songs together, as the multitudinous bride, will work perfectly as one as well. So in fact, it is a great analogy to the bride. We read in Ephesians 4:3, "Endeavoring to keep the unity of the Spirit in the bond of peace." And this is that unity of all working together as one. "Thy cheeks with rows of jewels," we read in verse 10. It says, "Thy cheeks are comely with rows of jewels, thy neck with chains of gold." Well, of jewels there is not in the original. If we look in the Revised Version, it says with plates of hair, which would be referring to long hair. And we know that long hair symbolizes glory and subjection. In contrast, we read 1 Corinthians 11:7, "For a man indeed ought not to cover his head, for as much as he is the image and glory of God, but the woman is the glory of the man." In verse 15, "But if a woman have long hair, it is a glory to her, for her hair is given for a covering." So this is what that is referring to in this verse. And again, on the next phrase, "thy neck with chains of gold," the "of gold" is added. Just leaving us with "thy neck with chains." The Revised Version actually has "chains of jewels." We have an examples of that it symbolizes authority. And we can read about that in Genesis 41 and Daniel 5. Now, the bride's authority is really a token of the authority yet to come at the time of the marriage. We read in Revelation 5:10, "And hast made us unto our God kings and priests, and we shall reign on the earth." This is that authority that is yet to come. Now, if we continue on to verse 11, it says, "We will make thee borders of gold with studs of silver." Now, this is the virgin speaking to the bride, and this is their part, how they want to take part in this. Borders of gold and studs of silver. Well, the gold would be hanging from the head. That is symbolic of tried faith. And the studs of silver intertwined would symbolize redemption, and that is combined with faith. And we see some examples of that in Leviticus and Exodus of how that silver fits with redemption. So the virgins can be incorporated into this multitudinous bride. They find their redemption through tried faith. So this is the kind of how all of that fits together with the virgins and their interaction with the bride. And if we go on to verses 12 through 14, we see the bride speaking now. "While the king sitteth at his table, my spikenard sendeth forth the smell thereof. A bundle of myrrh is my well-beloved unto me. He shall lie all night betwixt my breasts. My beloved is unto me as a cluster of camphor in the vineyards of Engedi." Now, in speaking of the king sitting at the table, there's a great symbol there, and that is fellowship. We know that if we sit around a table just to eat a meal, we have fellowship one with another. Spikenard means to glisten and shine. It's a very valued ointment. Back in that time, they carried it with them on their person. And we know that Mary anointed Jesus' feet, and spikenard was refused. Now, myrrh means bitter, and we know that bitterness can be identified with death. We see in John chapter 19. And that myrrh was also worn on the person. Now, it says, "A bundle of myrrh is my well-beloved unto me. He shall lie all night betwixt my breasts." That "he shall lay all night" is actually, in the Revised Version, "it" or "that." So it's speaking about the myrrh and not the groom. So that can be a little bit confusing, but the Revised Version makes it much more clear that it's speaking about the myrrh and how it fits there because it was also worn on the person. So the representation there is the dwelling with Christ in our hearts. We think of the bitterness of his death, we think of the, as we were back into of the spikenard, how it was a valued ointment, how it glistened and shined. So if we can let our knowledge shine forth and our faith shine forth, and keep in mind the great sacrifice of Christ for us, that is how we can represent Christ in our hearts. Now it speaks of the vineyards of Engedi. My beloved is unto me as a cluster of camphor in the vineyard of Engedi. And that was east of Bethlehem, near Jericho. Now if we think about that table, we see that Jesus also sat around the table before he was crucified at the Last Supper, Christ with his disciples. We read about that every week. And we also know that the reason we speak about that every week is because a new feast was instituted for us to follow. We follow that same example. And indeed, it is the same table that we all meet around. The camphor, the Revised Version says henna flowers, and the Authorized Version cypress. And those symbolize being outwardly beautiful, or showing forth the great gift that the bride has. So with the myrrh and camphor, we can see the combined application there of having Christ in our hearts inwardly and displayed outwardly in our character. And Engedi was a beautiful oasis and a refuge. So the camphor in the vineyard of Engedi, we find ourselves a refuge in Christ. Now if we continue on to verse 15, we see the bridegroom now speaking to the bride. He says, "Behold, thou art fair, my love. Behold, thou art fair. Thou hast dove's eyes." Once again, he calls her beautiful, even though she doubted her beauty. Thou art fair. Even in human relationships, love can bring out beauty. We sometimes think that someone, if we just looked at them without knowing them, we think, well, maybe they're not that outwardly beautiful. But if we get to know someone, all of a sudden, even their outward beauty can increase, and we think even outwardly that they are beautiful. It says, "Thou hast dove's eyes," and we know from Matthew 10:16 that a dove symbolizes something that's mild, harmless, chaste, and faithful. And that the doves of Syria were known for their large, beautiful eyes. If we look into someone's eyes, we often can kind of see what they're thinking or what they're feeling. It's kind of a gateway to the mind. So it's a great symbol talking about the bride having dove's eyes. Now the bride talks to the bridegroom next, and she says, "Behold, thou art fair, my beloved, yea, pleasant. Also our bed is green. The beams of our house are cedar, and our rafters of fir. I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys." So once again, we see the same word there used, "Behold, thou art fair." So this compliment is returned to the bridegroom. Yea, pleasant. Fair speaking about appearance, and perhaps pleasant being in action. Now if we read "bed is green," we might take that to be the marriage bed, but if we look in the Revised Version, it says couch or a place of rest. So we see that the bride is is using the bridegroom more as a place of refuge. And the color green can mean new or prosperous. So we know if we're tired out and we have someone that can comfort us, some place that we can rest, we know that we can come out of that much more refreshed and feeling new again. Verse 17 says, "Behold, thou art the beams of our house are cedar and rafters of fir." From Hosea, we see that cedar symbolizes glory, and that is that it symbolizes incorruptibility as well, whether it be a house, the ecclesia. And we see that from Hebrews 3, verse 6. And it says the rafters of fir, or galleries of fir, as the margin puts it. And that is often translated cypresses, which symbolizes beauty and strength. And finally, the rose of Sharon, lily of the valley. It says, "I am the rose of Sharon and the lily of the valleys." The Revised Version has autumn crocus, and that's a five-leafed flower, and that could be significant in the number five being of grace. This was the autumn crocus is a common flower. It was beautiful, but it was a very common one. So she's describing herself yet again modestly. And she says, the lily of the valleys. And the word lily is Shoshana, and six is Sheesh, which we see inside that word. And it's of course means sinful, the number six. Sinful like all mankind. So once again, she shows her modesty, acknowledging her sinfulness. Now the groom replies to the bride in verse 2. "As the lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters." So he's speaking of the bride standing out. She is the lily of the valleys, she said. And so he says, "As the lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters." So here's a beautiful plant standing out from among the thorns or sinners. Now the bride responds to the bridegroom in verses 3 through 6. "As the apple tree among the trees of the wood, so is my beloved among the sons. I sat down under his shadow with great delight, and his fruit was sweet unto my taste. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. Stay with me with flagons, comfort me with apples, for I am sick of love. His left hand is under my head, and his right hand doth embrace me." So once again, this shows, as we said, the bride's great devotion to the bridegroom. Now we read the apple tree in verse 3 there, and that was not indigenous to that area. And if we look at the translations, many think that it was probably an orange tree or some kind of a citrus tree. And the orange makes a good example. It was a sweet fruit. And it's the same word as in Proverbs 25:11, where it speaks of apples of gold upon its wheels. And if you think of what an orange looks like when we open it up, it looks like a wheel. And if we cut an orange in half, we can see 8 or 10 sections that are pretty much all look the same. All individual sections. And that's a good symbol of the individuals making up the ecclesia of the bride. but yet they're all part of the same fruit. So while there are many individuals, there is a perfect unity between them. It says, he brought me to the banqueting house. And that's the same as we are. We are brought to the vineyard. The banquet house also means house of wine, or as it speaks of Israel in Ezekiel 15. So we have all been brought to the vineyard, but it's up to us to produce the fruit and to work in that vineyard. And it's referred to in Esther chapter 5 as a place of favor to be brought into the banqueting house. What a great place of favor for us to be brought into the vineyard to work. What a great privilege indeed. It says the banner over me was love. And we know that a banner was used by soldiers to that they would carry into battle to show, you know, with whom they had their allegiance. And so we can see this, how this fits in nicely with this, that his banner over me was love. That's where the allegiance lies. We continue to verses 5 and 6. It says, stay me with flagons, comfort me with apples, for I am sick of love. We read in Ephesians 3:16, we need his strength. Ephesians 3:16 is an example of that, but we need his strength both now and when we stand before him. And if we read that word flagons, in the Revised Version it says cakes of raisins. Of course, that can be the dried fruit or the fruit of the labor of the vineyard. And it also mentions, I sat down under his shadow with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. We talked earlier about the bride seeking refuge or shelter through the groom. And this labor in the vineyard gives us the fruit of the tree under which she rests. We have that same comfort, that same shelter through Christ and God's great plan for the earth. And we can see that and read about it whenever we want through our scriptures. Now again, this is something, I don't know how many husbands out there might have said that to their wife, but they're sick of love. I know I've said that many times, but it actually, if you turn it around, it makes maybe a little more sense of being lovesick. That you just yearn for your partner. It's an affection that you have, that you just have to be with them, that you want to do anything to be with them. And this is an affection that must be developed. And as that is developed, then we find ourselves desiring to be with the groom more and more. Now in verse 6, we read, his left hand is under my head, and his right hand doth embrace me. So the head, or wisdom, can symbolize wisdom, is supported by Christ. And the right hand symbolizes an embrace or power of, or security of the groom. And we have that same kind of security right now, as we have spoken of, that we have Christ as our security. We have the wisdom through the scriptures that we can get. We have the faith and the way of redemption through Christ. And finally, verse 7, we see the bride speaking to the virgins. She says, I charge you, O ye daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that ye stir not up nor awake my love till he please. By the rose and by the hinds of the field. And a roe is often associated with a gazelle, and a hind, a female deer. So through these things, we we see the illustration of beauty and speed and elusiveness. It says, stir up my love. And actually, the word my is not in the original. So it says, stir not up nor awake love till he please. And so it's speaking of love in general, that true love cannot be artificial. It cannot be something that you can go to an evangelist for and that he can get you all excited and riled up and all of a sudden you have love and you have these intense feelings. It's something that has to grow over time. And it says, stir not up nor awake my love till he please. Or the RV, the revised version says, till it please. So love must be unforced and drawn out from the groom's qualities. So we must use the groom as an example to follow. To look at all those qualities and slowly but surely try to become a character that is full of those qualities. And that's why it's so important we know if we have an infatuation or a crush on someone, how short-lived it might be. But in order to develop a true love, that we must develop it over time. So that is the end of the two songs. And as we continue these songs, we need to remember whenever we read of the virgins, of how they are the individual members of the ecclesia. And also keep in mind that some are foolish and some are wise. So that's a great example for us to think about. That the bride is the perfected ecclesia, and that the bridegroom is Christ. So we need to make sure that we as individual members are wise, that we contribute and help each other to form that perfected ecclesia, so that when Christ comes for the marriage, that we will be ready. As the groom said, draw me. As the bride said, excuse me, draw me unto thee. We must find ourselves drawn to this time of that great marriage.